thank you for downloading this podcast from Guymyr Baptist Church. You can find out more about our church at our website, guymyrbaptist.org.au. May God speak to you as you listen.
Good morning. Our Bible reading is taken from Psalm 15, and I'm reading from the NIV. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? He whose walk is blameless and who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from his heart and has no slander on his tongue, who does his neighbour no wrong and casts no slur on his fellow man, who despises a vile man but honours those who fear the Lord, who keep his oath even when it hurts, who lends his money without usury and does not accept a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken.
I'll keep talking loudly or something about ice hockey possibly while we're waiting. We are continuing our series, as Jodine said, entitled Jesus and the Sydney Morning Herald, where we want to try to think Christianly about contemporary topics, events, and issues that are taking place in our world. And this is a pretty important exercise for us as believers. In reality, we are trying to follow Jesus in our world. And so it's pretty handy if we can do that more effectively. And it's helpful to be able to engage with the things that are taking place around us. But it's also helpful from the perspective of the mission that we believe that God has invited us to participate with. If Jesus is restoring and renewing all things, then it's helpful to know which things need to be restored and which things perhaps we can leave alone or at least affirm in one way, shape, or form. And so this series that we do in January is kind of to kind of be involved in kind of whatever's taking place during January. Sometimes you kind of pray for more news than there actually is, and other weeks there's too much news and whatnot, but to try to think Christianly about these sorts of things. And last week we looked at the Danish word hygge, which describes the Danish art of living well. You can listen to that online if you would like. It's apparently going to be all the rage, or is all the rage, particularly in the lifestyle and home section of the newspaper. It was also kind of a finalist for Word of the Year with both Oxford and Collins dictionaries. But this morning we want to look at actually another kind of word of the year. This is not a word that you might just happen to bump into if you have a trendy friend who really likes Danish things. This is actually the reality that we now live and move in. And it's Oxford Dictionary's word of the year, post-truth. This is an adjective, and it means this: relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. All right, so the objective reality, what is objectively true, what we could actually fact check against, what we could determine is accurate one way or another, is not as important as the emotion or what people want to be true. You don't have to think much further than Brexit, or the rise and success of Donald Trump. What was surprising about Trump, well, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's surprising. One of the things that was surprising about Trump is that he could lie about things and that he got away with it. And not that he lied and no one picked it and then they exposed him. He would say something that was just outright wrong and it was immediately embraced by a certain selection of the population. So, for instance, you know, his declaration that when 9/11 happened, thousands of Muslims celebrated on rooftops in New York. That's just not right. It's wrong. It's a lie. But for many people who voted for him, they wanted it to be true. It expressed believability. And so the appeal to emotion, the appeal to their fears, ends up becoming more important than what is objectively true, post-truth. Does that make a little bit of sense? Is it frightening? Yeah. You may have seen a few of these articles in the Sydney Morning Herald over the last couple of months or so. Margaret Sullivan on December the 3rd wrote that Donald Trump has ushered in a world without facts that's scarier than you think. Paul McGough on December 6th, in a piece that's a little bit longer because it's an analysis, is what the internet did for journalism, Donald Trump is doing for public reality. And Layson Haydad on December 19th from Al Jazeera, speaking the truth in the post-truth era. And if you bumped into any of these articles, the word post-truth is used fairly frequently. Oxford Dictionary, when they released the word of the year, actually had kind of a chart which kind of traced how frequently the word was in use. And that was one of the reasons why they added it to the dictionary. And it's because it's used a little bit in the years prior. And then in 2016, it became very, 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 very prominent as people tried to explain what was taking place in the world that we were living in. More helpful for me this week has actually been a book by Ralph Keyes. It's called The Post-Truth Era, Dishonesty and Deception in Contemporary Life. It was published in 2004 and was incredibly helpful to kind of understand and figure out what post-truth is all about. The term is not original with him. He actually traces it to an article that he read in 1992 by a now late journalist. But this book, The Post-Truth Era, has kind of really put it on the map. And if you search post-truth on Amazon, this is one of the books that kind of comes up. I bought it. It's very good. And I was kind of left in a bit of a quandary because it's a Baptist church. We believe in the Bible. I don't want this to be the good news according to Ralph Keyes, which it won't be because it's mostly bad news according to Ralph Keyes, but I don't want it to be the news according to Ralph Keyes, nor do I necessarily want this to become some sort of book review. But as I was grappling with it, I thought, you know, it's actually really, really helpful when you have excellent analysis of our culture. Because if we as Christians are going to think Christianly about things, we actually need to know what we're thinking about first. And so while I don't, we will return to Psalm 15 in a little while and whatnot, I guess I want to give a bit of an apology in the best sort of sense, in terms of a defense, for using this. When you think about the Bible tells a particular story with a particular emphasis and is not really interested in lots of questions that we have. I don't know if you've noticed that. Right? The Bible tells its own story, and we find ourselves in its pages, and it speaks broadly of things that are true in lots of different ways. But think for a moment about the situation about lying. How would you answer, biblically speaking, the question, why do we lie? Just think about that for a second. So you had to come up with a reason biblically why we lie. Well, we're sinners, aren't we? We're sinners, and therefore, you know, anything that's self-serving and gets me off the hook or makes me look good, I'm probably prone to have a crack at. Our hearts are deceitful. I think that's in Jeremiah. They're deceitful above all things, and so we can even deceive ourselves into thinking that the truth that we are telling is, or the lie that we're telling is the truth, and all of those sorts of things. And we are those who have been influenced by the father of lies, why we lie. Now, that's all, broadly speaking, true, isn't it? But in terms of a deeper analysis of it, that's not what we find in Scripture, is it? Because, to be honest, the Bible isn't actually all that interested to explain why we lie. In fact, lots of the stories that tell stories of lying are just interested in telling us the outcome of the lies, not necessarily the motivation for the lies. So remember the story of David and Bathsheba? It's just a sordid tale, and David, well, he lies. The author never says this is why he lied. Because the author doesn't really care. David lied. This is the outcome. The reasons are kind of left to the side. And so as a story, it's not really helpful for us to analyze why we lie. Are you with me so far? So Ralph Keyes lists these as some of the reasons why we lie. We lie to get ahead. We lie to make money. He also says we lie to make time, about why we're late or why we can't be there on time or whatever it might be. We lie to avoid embarrassment or conflict. We lie to wiggle out of tight spots. We lie because we're insecure and feel we need to look a little bit better or sound a little bit better than we actually are. We lie for recreation because creativity is required when you're lying, and so it's kind of this wonderful expression of human dignity and creativity in a funny way. We lie for the adventure of it because there's a bit of risk involved. What if I get caught out this time? And so it's kind of like jumping out of a plane, but a little bit safer in that sort of sense. We lie to take charge of circumstances and situations, particularly when we feel powerless within them. These are some of the reasons why we lie. I found that really helpful. Far more helpful, if I can put it this way, than the biblical analysis of why I lie. Because the Bible's not primarily interested in why I lie, apart from the fact that I'm a sinner, which is true. You with me so far? So these sorts of books are really quite helpful for us. So without making this a book review, although if you want to borrow the book, you can. It's very good and very worth a read. And without making this the good news according to Ralph Keyes, let me give you some of his insights that will help us then think a little bit Christianly about the post-truth era in which we now find ourselves. He opens with a quote from Daniel Boorstin, who is a historian, I understand, and he says, "Truth has been displaced by believability." Truth has been displaced by believability. What sounds like truth or what we want to be true becomes more important than what actually is true in a post-truth era. And he says that he has three kind of big ideas that he wants to explore in the book. He says, this book's premise is that we may be no more prone to making things up than our ancestors were, but we are better able to get away with deceiving others. We are more likely to be let off the hook if exposed, and in the process, convince ourselves that no harm's been done. Those are the three premises. He doesn't want to say that we are as humans, more prone to lying than anyone ever in the past. He says, no, you know what? I think people have always wanted to lie. The deal for us now is it's easier to get away with. If we get caught, we're more likely to get let off the hook because the social consequences for lying have been diminished, and we can end up convincing ourselves that it's, broadly speaking, okay because no harm has been done. Now, let me be very clear here. This is not a sermon where we in the church, the honest ones, shake our finger at everyone out there who is a big, big liar. We need to find ourselves in the pages of the book. We need to hear this and understand that we have been influenced by this the same way. One of the things that was quite, I wouldn't say startling, but a little bit, it took me back, is to realize that I relatively routinely tell fibs. And so do you, I bet. And notice I called it a fib, because to call it a lie means that I'm a liar. And I'm not a liar, right? As Keyes points out, we have a kind of a ledger book morality. If I tell more truthful things than lies, then I'm obviously honest, right? So I just have to keep track to make sure there's kind of more positive than negatives, and then we're fine. But we have more euphemisms for telling lies than we do for just about anything else in our world. Think about the number of ways that we talk about things that are not quite true. We talk about white lies, or we doctor the truth, or we stretch the truth, or we bend it, or we might misrepresent it, or we speak carelessly, or as Emily Dickinson said, we tell it slant. We use rhetorical excess. We use poetic license. We talk about things that are nearly true or are based, kind of facts-based information. We massage the truth. We soften the truth. We improve the truth. We spin the truth. And in none of those things are we lying, except that we are always lying. Right, the classic, isn't it? How are you? I'm fine. Are you really? Yes. Don't make me lie. Answer again, right? All the way through to how we tell part truths. I caught myself doing it the other day. I just said to someone, I told someone what I had done, and I didn't need to add anything else to it. I just need to say, this is what I'd done. But I gave a reason, and I gave part of the reason why I had done the thing that I had done, and I realized that I had withheld part of the truth. I thought, wow, I'd do this a little bit more frequently than I realized. When people would say, hey, do you have time to kind of catch up? And I would say, no, I can't. Not true. I don't want to. I'm not able. Because I don't want to. I'm telling half the truth. Are you hearing me? You and I are caught up in this. Keyes talks about them as casual and lazy lies. Unnecessary things where we tell part of the truth or we bend it a little bit or we stretch it just a little bit. We have been caught up in this. And it's not, I don't believe that I'm a liar. But I've realized just how easy it is, to lie to friends and family and at work and online, and on it goes. This is something that we are caught up in. And this is, of course, despite a Christian tradition that says that lying is always wrong. Apart from, you know, kind of keeping marital bliss and saving your life and those sorts of things, right? There's a few places where we would say that lying is okay, more or less, right? And biblically, we got some really interesting stories. There are some really interesting stories about lies that are rewarded in the Bible. Remember the midwives who were told to kill all the Hebrew children, and they didn't? And Pharaoh brings them forward and says, why haven't you killed them? They said, well, the Hebrew women just have children so quickly that we don't get there in time. And by the time we get there, the children have already been born and they're whisked away to safety. And the text says that because they did that, the Lord gave them children. So the moral of that story is, you know, I wonder if Roxanne covers that in Sunday school, actually. Right? Same thing happens with Rahab. She lies about the spies, and she's incorporated into the people of God. Jacob deceives his father, flat out deceives his father, and receives the blessing, and God says, yep, that's right, it's yours. Joseph deceives his brothers. When they come to Egypt, he just flat out deceives them. And we go, oh, yeah, so that's just to test if they'd actually changed. Doesn't matter. He still deceived them. We assume that Solomon deceived the two prostitutes who came in, and that he wasn't actually going to cut the baby in half. He deceived them for the purposes of seeing who was actually telling the truth. There's lots and lots of those ambiguous little places. It's life for us. So what do we do? Well, Keyes goes on to analyze honesty, and some of this stuff is, I think, really quite helpful for us. He talks about how honesty, and he doesn't talk about it from a theological perspective, but he talks about it from a social perspective. He says honesty is critical to communities. He says in any sort of community that you have, right, you have to have a degree of honesty or the community will fall apart. In fact, many of our words for truth actually reflect fidelity first and foremost. Keyes quotes that old Beach Boys song, "Be True to Your School." But we use that language of something being true or being true to someone. It's about fidelity. It's not necessarily about accuracy so much that we're interested in. It's critical for communities. It's critical for free market economies. Our economy is based on honesty. That when companies say that they're selling things well, that they're selling things well. That the accounting is not creative, another euphemism for how we can tell things that are not quite true, but that it is accurate. Because if it's accurate, then we know how they're doing and how we're going and the investments and all of those sorts of things. Honesty is built in, and we know the devastation that comes when people are caught creatively accounting or just flat out lying about things economically. It's critical in the scientific community. It's critical in law. But the community component is what's most important. Keyes argues that one of the most significant reasons why dishonesty is that much easier is because we are a far more mobile community than ever before. See, if you grew up in a town of 300 people and everyone always stayed there, you were going to have a hard time stringing together a long list of lies, weren't you? Because too many people knew too much about you. We move every 3, 5, 7 years. If we kind of did a survey of those of you who were here 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it would be pretty interesting. And you're all of a sudden in a new place where nobody knows you, where nobody knows you well enough. And so dishonesty is not kind of an automatic, but it certainly becomes easier. Other enablers of the post-truth era include things like the therapeutic model. He talks about therapy, and he doesn't say therapy leads to dishonesty, but in a therapy session, in a counseling session, for those of you, many of us have been to counselors, the premise is I can say whatever I need to say. I can be completely honest, or I can lie. It doesn't matter, because the counselor is not going to judge me on those things, but allows me a safe space. Keyes says that's really helpful in counseling. He said it doesn't really work in real life. If we assume that everything just is responded to non-judgmentally, he said we're in all sorts of trouble. And that non-judgmental approach, the therapeutic approach to relationships, what's good for you, what's helpful for you, what's authentic and genuine for you, trumps truth and makes it a little bit easier for us to be dishonest. He talks about post-modernity. If you've gone to university in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, or now, you will bump into postmodern denials of truth. Postmodernity essentially denies that there is any big story that binds everything together, but that truth is socially constructed, that we decide on what truth is. Does this sound vaguely familiar? And therefore, your truth is as good as my truth, or our truth is as good as their truth, as ever might be. It's based largely on linguistics, where they basically realize that, you know, the color red is just an arbitrary word. We've decided that the sound of those three letters, red, signifies a color. But we could have decided that purple signified that color, or that white signified that color. We just made it up. There's no kind of, you know, divine dictionary where we kind of go, oh, okay, that's red apparently. We've constructed it. And so this means all sorts of trouble for truth, and Key says that makes it a little bit easier for us. He talks about technology. You know, it's a good standard practice not to use your real name online. Right? I mean, you don't want to give all your details online. That's just foolish. And so we hide behind anonymity, which makes dishonesty a whole lot easier. If you don't know, it's really Mark Rader, the senior pastor at Gamia Baptist Church, that I can say a whole bunch of stuff. Really, it doesn't matter. He talks about media. And this is before Twitter and Facebook kind of really hit the scene. In a very excellent TED Talk, it's 9 minutes long, by Eli Pariser, I'm guessing that's how he says his last name, he talks about beware of online filter bubbles. You ever heard of a filter bubble? Essentially, Google, Yahoo News, Facebook, heaps of other things use complex algorithms to dictate what we receive in our Facebook feed or whatever it might be, right? And these algorithms mean that we end up just getting all the stuff that we already agree with. So the fellow who does the little TED Talk, he says, I actually got a handful of friends to all Google the same thing and send me a screenshot of the front page. And they were different. Because the algorithms are based on the computer that you're using and the location of where you're at and all your history and all of those sorts of things to determine what you see. And the danger is that we end up, as in this case, just getting a whole bunch of, if we're blue, the little U is blue, all the bubbles are blue. And all the reds and the purples and the greens, the stuff that we might not agree with or might not be interested in, is just left out of the filters. And we end up in this little bubble where everything that we hear affirms everything that we believe. Isn't the world great? Everyone agrees with me. Except they don't. And we don't hear about it. This makes dishonesty easier for us as well. And the social consequences are critical, aren't they? He talks about the fact that society has become far more suspicious. But he says the stage beyond suspicion is resignation. The resignation that, you know what, we're just going to be lied to, so it just doesn't matter. And once you've been resigned to hearing the falseness, you become cynical. He talks a couple of times about totalitarian governments, and that totalitarian governments tend to kind of send out streams of false information in order to make, essentially, the people that they're ruling give up and just not care anymore. Now, we're pretty suspicious. I suspect that we've moved beyond suspicion to resignation and cynicism, particularly about governments. Does anyone believe anything that's coming out of Canberra right now? Really? Does anyone believe that what we hear is absolutely, honestly the truth all the time? No, come on. That's not a great place for a complex society to be, is it? It's not very good for our own communities. You know, one of the things that we talk about as a community of faith is that it'd be nice if we had a stronger sense of community. Well, one of the things that builds community and facilitates community is honesty. How honest are we? Do people here know you? Are there enough people here who know you well enough to tell? All those sorts of questions. Post-truth era. So, what do we do? And at this, I'd like to turn from Ralph to the Bible. Because while Ralph Keyes has an excellent analysis of truthfulness, he does not approach it from a theological or religious perspective. He makes a case for honesty at the end of the book, basically saying honesty is better for you and better for us. Right? It takes less mental energy to tell the true lie. Right? Because once you tell one lie, you have to first of all remember that lie and who you told it to, and possibly come up with 3 or 4 or 5 or 20 others to back that one lie up. It's just easier to tell the truth. Furthermore, it's better for us as a community. And while that's true, and I think we can agree with that, I think ultimately for those of us who are followers of Jesus and seeking to be part of his mission, I think we need to take up that same call. We need to be people who are more honest. Keyes talks about getting rid of the casual, lazy lies in our lives. And I reckon that's a pretty good place to start. Now, notice I've said be more honest, not totally honest. Because in a broken world, total honesty can actually be really cruel, can't it? It can be really cruel. And it can actually be really awkward. He says truth-telling is a two-person proposition. One person to tell, one person to listen. And I think therein lies the solution to the dilemma about how are you, right? Some of you are already looking forward to getting your coffee because you know someone's going to ask, how are you? Now, here's the deal. In a truth-telling proposition that takes two people, I need to believe that you can handle the truth that I want to tell, and you need to want to hear the truth that I want to tell. Often, when we're having social interaction over here, what I really want is just to start a conversation. How are you? I'm fine. Yeah, so am I. Good. You have a good Christmas. And off we go. Now, if you believe that I can handle the truth that you need to tell me, then tell me. I'm willing to listen to you. But when you go out and get your coffee and someone says, how are you? If I can paraphrase Jesus' words, let their fine be a fine. If they say fine, don't say really, because then you're going to make them lie. And that's not very nice. If you ask someone, how are you, and they say, I'm fine, believe them. And for those who are asked, how are you, there may be a time and a place for you to speak the truth to someone. That's important. Someone should be able to say that. But this is part of what we need to be about. We need to be about truthfulness, more honesty. In Psalm 15, let me draw your attention to this. The question is asked, Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy mountain? So what sort of a person can live with God? What sort of a person would be comfortable just kind of walking up God's holy hill and walking into the temple and saying, hey, Lord, and being part of furniture? What sort of person? Well, the psalmist answers that. Those whose walk is blameless, who do what is righteous, and then notice the emphasis of speech. Who speak the truth from their hearts. And I don't think that's about kind of just about motivation. I think what that's really about is about making sure that the things that we say are connected to our hearts. An ancient proverb from another, I think Mesopotamia, Babylon says, do not disconnect your tongue from your heart. Make sure that what your heart feels you are saying. Make sure there's a connection there. And he says, those who have no slander on their tongues, who do their neighbors no wrong, who cast no slur on others, who despise those whose ways are vile, but honor whoever fears the Lord, who keep their oaths even when it hurts, who lend money to the poor without interest, and do not accept bribes against the innocent, who does these things will never be shaken. Even there's a whole bunch of stuff in here about honesty, isn't there? Honesty in our language, honesty in our actions. Because if I accept a bribe on behalf of the rich, the poor, or against the wrong for the innocent, then I am acting dishonestly. I'm pretending that I'm going to be partial, and I'm not. This is what we're called to. Paul actually talks about the same sorts of things in Ephesians when he urges that community of faith in Ephesians chapter 4 to, let me just get this right here, lest I be lying. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbor, for we are all members of one body. As followers of Jesus, who follow the truth, and not so much in the sense of accuracy, but in faithfulness to the things of God, we should be those who speak honestly to each other. That's fairly straightforward. But we actually have an opportunity here as well to participate in the mission of God. You know, Shannon Sparks were here just before Christmas spoke about their missionary endeavors and living their faith out loud. Being honest is a way for us to live our faith out loud, to be people who live and speak in such ways that people know that we are honest, that they count on us for an opinion of truth. They can count on us, that we can be people who do not easily and simply like things on Facebook without first figuring out whether or not they're true. People who are interested in the perspective of those that we might disagree with in order that we might understand the whole picture. That we might be those who do not respond primarily out of emotion, but who also seek to find out what truth is and how that ought to influence our emotions. That we might be those who are more honest. And in doing that, I believe that we will become a beacon in our community. Because our world is suspicious. Our world is resigned to always being lied to. Our world is cynical of truth. And we can provide an answer for that by simply allowing our yes to be yes, our no to be no, telling the truth. In every circumstance, at every situation, whenever possible for us to do. I don't know if that's making sense to you. I had a lot of fun reading and thinking about it, but I also realized I probably had 4 or 5 weeks worth of material there. So if you want to come back for the second service, you might hear something completely different as I kind of massage all the bits and pieces into one theoretically coherent part. Take some time, though, now to respond in worship and prayer, and only liars need to come forward for prayer this morning. We have extra people on standby. But in seriousness, I think whenever we preach on a particular topic and then we offer prayer, there's the worry that people are going to assume that the topic is why you're coming forward for prayer. You know, and so Rhonda Montgomery comes forward, we think, I didn't know Rhonda was a chronic liar. I don't think anyone thinks those things, but we shouldn't either. This is part of our being honest with each other, really. This is about our desire to say, you know what? On our own, we're not enough. That we need God in all sorts of different ways. And possibly it's to be more truthful. But as Jodine reminded us, possibly it's because God's placed a particular word on your heart. There's a particular hope or desire that you have for this year. There's a decision that you're making, whatever it might be. So can we kind of put aside all those presuppositions and respond in truth and in the right spirit as we worship and pray together? So I'm going to invite Ron up. I'm going to take a moment to lead us in prayer and then invite the prayer team to come down in the front. And anytime during these next couple of songs, we would love to pray with you about anything that's going on in your life. So will you join me as we pray? Heavenly Father, we thank you for the great challenge it is to live Christianly in our world. And we thank you for good and careful analysis that helps us understand the world in which we live. And I pray that through your Spirit, you might help us to consider that from a theological perspective, that we might be able to unpack that and think about what it means of Jesus in our day and age. And Heavenly Father, in our post-truth era and the implications that that has, I pray that we might, as individuals and as a community, be more honest. Even though there are many things in our world that makes dishonesty easier, I pray that we might take the harder path and do the right thing. Help us to be honest with one another. Help us to be honest in our workplaces and with our families. Help us to be those who live in ways that are truthful and faithful in order that others might be drawn to understand how we do so and be introduced to the truth in Jesus Christ. And we pray these things in his name. Amen.